Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working building in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Need a professional place to work from? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tee and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
Dave Arnold, your host of Cookie Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday. You know when, anyway. From Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good.
We got Matt in the booth, who apparently is going to get married soon.
Oh, yeah. It's happening.
Yeah, when's that?
Next Friday.
Next Friday?
Yeah.
Where are you getting married?
Newport, Rhode Island.
Mm. Oh, that's so fancy. I didn't realize you were so fancy. Such
very
a fancy man.
I'm a fancy man.
Are you going to be at the Breakers? Is everyone going to be dressed in tuxedos? Are you going to have monkey butlers?
Sadly, none of those things. Be right on Easton's Beach.
Yeah. Cool.
Are you from Rhode Island?
No, my parents have lived there for the last, like, half a decade, so sort of.
Mm. It's nice over there.
Who's officiating?
One of our best friends.
Oh. Have you given... him, her, the Cooking Issues Guide to Wedding Officiants?
No, I think he's going to be all right on his own.
I was told that I made Nastasia's friend the wedding officiant.
Cry?
Could I have made her cry?
I've thought of the guide often.
Yeah, there you go.
No.
There you go. Well, anyway, you're gone next week, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if we don't, happy wedding.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good time.
Give him some advice, Dave. You love weddings.
What are you doing for the wine/liquor situation? What's going on there?
Margarita as signature cocktail. They tried to give me a jank recipe. I was like, no, thank you. I will give you the recipe.
Strong.
What?
Strong. Always give someone the recipe. They're still going to F it up, but strong.
Yeah. And then a keg of a very good local brewery. Shout out to Grace Ale in Rhode Island. I like it a lot. And then, I don't know, what are we doing? A bunch of wines, red, white, rosé, I don't remember what they are.
What are you doing for food?
Buffet style, bunch of stuff. Most people went with the lobster. It's going to be, like, real good.
That's good. You know what? I hope they have to open it themselves. I hope there's a good spray. Just a word of advice to anyone who ever, if you should ever hang out with me, don't sit anywhere near me if I'm eating lobster.
I mean, I feel like that's the whole wedding is going to be like that. I think we should give everyone individual tables because they will be spraying.
Yeah, I've had people like get up, move in disgust, and like leave because of the general spray of lobster juice around me when I'm eating lobster. Because I just don't. If you're serving someone lobster, like that's it, lobster. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Also, I don't like crackers. I only like using my hands. I don't use any sort of device.
I use only my teeth.
Teeth. If you have a big one on the claws, I've almost broken my teeth on lobster shells, cracking open the claws. But anyway, lobster cracking. Different day, different story. What was that, Anastasia?
Next round.
Yeah. That was round one.
Round one. Yeah. Well, here's what happened. In fairness, I told Anastasia that she wasn't allowed to put her foot on the table holding the microphones and jam the table up and down anymore. So it turns out I was wrong. When her foot is not attached to anything, the vibration level is so high. You familiar with the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, Galloping Gertie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Look that video up.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, check that out. That was, it's exact, almost exact same design as the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, in fact. But it had a resonant frequency that the wind used to make happen to it. I think it was in the 30s. And there's videos of the wind hitting it at just the right angle, hitting the resonant frequency, and the thing is going up and down like a jump rope until it finally snaps. So it turns out Anastasia needs to keep her foot on the table because otherwise the resonant frequency is so hard that she rattles her phone out of her pocket, all kinds of crazy stuff, right?
It was a mistake.
Hmm?
It was a mistake.
What, me telling you to take your foot off the table?
Yeah.
Today we have half of the people we're going to have on the air with us today. We have Jeremiah Stone of Contra NYC and Wild Air. And what? How many? You have also the pizza place. What else do you have now?
We're about to open a wine shop and a wine bar.
Okay, I'm going to get into this in a second. We're going to have in a minute, I call him Fabulous, you know, Fabian Von Hausky, but I've always called him Fabulous since I knew him when he was like 19, when he started coming to the French Culinary Institute. 18. He was 18?
He said he was 17 when he came to the, so yeah, I think he was 18.
God damn, he lied to me and said he was 21 because I had him drinking at the beginning.
Of course he did, yeah.
So like well-known, like, you know, at the top of the food game right now, I knew these guys back when. So call in your questions, either your Jeremiah or Fabulous related questions, to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Fabulous will be here in just a minute. So I knew both of these guys. I knew Fabulous when he started coming to the French Culinary Institute. He came twice.
Yep.
He came as a culinary student and then as a pastry student. But I'll wait for that for when he comes. It's his fault, by the way, people, that the technique of blending and then centrifuging stuff is called justino. We'll get into that later. But at the same time, Jeremiah, I think at one point was a student, but I didn't know you when you were a student, right?
A little bit, not really.
What, were you there?
We knew him as he was running the
events,
events in the amphitheater. So the way the French Culinary Institute used to work, maybe still does, is we have like an amphitheater, and every, what was it, like Wednesday usually, or like Tuesdays, Wednesdays, in the middle of the week, they'd get very well-known chefs or interesting chefs or anyone who would come and do what I thought were pretty awesome food demos. Right?
Yeah, we did food demos, did, you know, private events, we did classes with you, Harold McGee.
Yeah, right. But I mean, we had a lot of interesting people coming through doing like weird cooking stuff.
Yeah.
And so it was like a great opportunity to kind of meet people, like learn new techniques, see what was going on. And so Jeremiah was down there. And so, at one point, like we were always friendly, but you were kind of my mortal enemy because I would go F up your kitchen. F the place up.
You were not my mortal. I don't know where you're getting that from. You might have effed up the kitchen, but I loved you guys. We were always friends.
Yeah. Here's Fabulous. So he's coming in. So anyway, so like I knew these guys way back when, and then I figured they'd both do something, but I had no idea they were going to start something together, which was weird.
No, it was weird because I actually, when he first started interning for you, I didn't like him at all.
Why not? At least right here.
A lot of your interns were very entitled and, they wanted to be part of the whirlwind, so.
He's talking shit about you.
No.
Hey, Fabulous.
Hello.
So Jeremiah is talking crap about you. It says when you first came to the FCI, he didn't like you because all of the interns were, he said, entitled.
I mean, I didn't like him either.
So then how did you end up?
I wasn't entitled.
So like, did you like him before or after he had $10,000 worth of sneakers stolen from him?
I still don't like him.
So for those of you that don't know,
what?
Jeremiah is a sneakerhead. He came to me one day and he was like, I had $10,000 worth of sneakers stolen from me. I was like, who the hell owns $10,000 worth of sneakers?
Yeah, but you're assuming that that's $10,000 of, you know, $70 sneakers. That could be like 10 shoes, you know?
Was it? Well, what was it?
It was a lot of shoes, though.
It's probably like maybe 12 shoes, yeah. Just very rare. But it wasn't, I don't think it was 10,000. I think it was maybe 5,000.
Who did it?
Oh, somebody random, because they came in, they saw, they took speakers and
it
everything.
It can't be random. Who knows who, random thief is like, man, these sneakers?
No, but I mean, like, it's hard to explain. I mean, like,
if thieves now walk around with like cell phones and like look up the value of crap on the internet before they steal it. Whoa, only steals your good books and the good sneakers.
No, but you see that they break in and they take the TV, they take all the electronic equipment, and
who
then
takes a TV anymore.
And then he sees a pair.
Oh, this was 10 years ago.
It's Jordans, you know. Yeah, this is when the biggest TV out was 32 inches.
There were no computers then.
Yeah. And yet this thief, random thief. Happen to know about these fancy sneakers.
Well, like, you know, everyone knows. I mean, everyone, if you steal, you steal. You steal everything.
Yeah.
You know what Jordans are worth, you know.
All right. So now, you two hated each other. And
we
then
didn't
how
hate
did
each other. I just, when I first met him, I didn't like him because I didn't like any of, like, I ended up liking a lot, most of the interns, but it's just when you first meet them.
Well, it's like, you call them entitled, but how much, fabulous, how much did the FCI cost at that point?
A lot.
Like a lot.
Yeah.
Like a lot.
I don't know. Well, how much was it? Like 40?
Yeah, just probably shy of 40.
Okay. Yeah. So it's like, this is what Nastasia never understood. We had these interns.
They were real crappy.
And Nastasia, who ran the program after Mindy, who ran the program first, left. Nastasia never, ever, ever, ever understood that these people were not working for us. Even though we were making them work, they were also paying $40,000, and this was one of the perks, was that they got to be in this program. So Nastasia never kind of understood this. You know what I mean? And that's where you're saying the sense of entitlement came from. But the fact of the matter is that they were both, like, they were both customers and employees, and it's a hard line to kind of ride.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's also, especially when one was interning with you, you just got thrown into, I mean, everyone was there at the time, like all the chefs who were like sort of relevant at the time were there, and you got to hang out with them and work with them. And, you know, like I, even with Johnny that I worked with afterwards, like me and him had a relationship prior to me working with him. So it was just a very weird situation where you just knew a lot of people. And then, you know, in a very sort of short and like very close, place, proximity.
Yeah.
So I think it was just very easy to get lost in that, other than just working. And that's where a lot of it came, you know. I also didn't like a lot of them.
Well, you know? No, you hated everyone and still do, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that was good back in the day that would like, you can't
what's up,
do
Wee
anymore.
Pop?
Oh, you don't hate, you love Wee Pop. You just said he was dead.
So I said, what's up, Wee Pop?
You know, Wee Pop now owns one of the biggest clubs, and he apparently has the best stereo system in all of Southeast Asia.
You know that guy, the pastry chef at Nightshade, is Wee Pop's cousin.
Wow. That's crazy.
Wee Pop Supapi Pop?
Wee Pop Supapi Bam. But you can call me Bam.
So this guy, he's one of the engineers who came up with Nomiku. So he worked on the original Nomiku, which was, you know, whatever you think, Nomiku was the reason that circulators are inexpensively priced now. Immersion circulators used to be like $1,000. They were $2,000, then they were $1,000, then they were $800.
They're the flat screen TV of the culinary world.
Yeah, and then Wee Pop was like, why does it cost that much? He started doing the Nomiku, and then as soon as Nomiku hit, everything was $400, and now it's like $200. You know what I mean? So it's like, I think people don't give the Supapi Pot enough credit for that.
Yeah.
But remember, like, he shortened his name from Wee Pop Supapi Pot to Wee Pot Supi Pot to because he couldn't fit the name on his on his chef's whites at the French Culinary Institute, and he came up.
I thought it just continued underneath his armpit.
Yeah, well, that, and he was like, just call me Bam, and we're like, no. Nah.
What was his brother's name?
Forget.
Oh yeah, his brother's name was like it was even better.
But he came in and we're all like, hey, and then we're like, hey, you Thai? And he's like, how'd you guess? And we're like, what? You know what I mean? Like,
there's
what?
17 characters.
I like Wee Pop.
Wee Pop's good business.
I like Wee Pop, Cho. Gutterball.
Nipples.
No, Gutterball. No, Gutterball
Ross?
I hated. Well, who was Gutterball? Ross? Oh yeah, I like Ross.
Yeah.
Ross was Yahtzee.
Oh, Ross was Yahtzee. Anyway, for those of you who don't know, all of the interns, so we had this program at the French Culinary Institute called the Tech Program, which for a long time was housed in a closet in the basement of the amphitheater. And then when Nastasia started working, we moved up in the world, literally to the fourth floor, and were put into a garbage closet.
Well, no, then we ran out of that hall, like the outside of the.
Yeah, but he's saying that used to be a garbage closet.
That was garbage.
That was a garbage closet.
That, we they were didn't, when we moved
hallway.
Into it.
Oh, yeah, you were in the hallway.
We were
in
the hallway.
In the hallway, And when
that was only like a couple
weeks. When we moved in, they didn't bother cleaning. So literally, there was garbage dumpsters in there, and the students would just hurl, or the, you know, the, also the staff would just hurl bags of garbage into the dumpsters. And so if you've ever been in a dumpster room, there's like that line of garbage at the level of the dumpster where there's like that spray of garbage. It's like, you ever like, yeah, like on a griddle, you know, when a griddle's not protected and you can see like the pancake line from when pancakes are flipped, you can see that line of grease and pancake splatter on the wall. So it was like that in the garbage room at the toss level, and no one ever cleaned it.
Well, and then people weren't informed that it wasn't the garbage anymore, so
they kept on putting garbage.
You'd be
in.
Working, and someone would dump a bag of.
Or they'd have an event, and they would just shove every chair on the floor into our room.
What would you do?
So, like, I just got this is where, like, okay, this, people, this is where I started becoming impatient. I used to be
okay.
No, seriously, my wife even asked my wife. I used to be a completely patient person because I worked with myself, by myself, for myself. Like when I worked for the lawyers, I did my own job. I didn't have to work with anyone. I just did my job. I went home. So like everything was very mellow. As soon as I had to start like interacting with people, that's when I lost all my patience. Like I think I had a finite amount of patience and it was just never tapped. And now I'm just at zero all the time. I mean, at 100, I guess, at the boiling point. So like, yeah, I used to just walk in and I would just pick up the chairs and just throw them down the hallway. Bam, 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 bam. Throw them down the hallway. Because I'm like,
this is no exaggeration.
Right. I'm like, if they have like so little. First of all, when I started working for the French Culinary, they said they were going to build me a lab, right? And it went from build me a lab to maybe we'll fire you, right?
To maybe you can live in the trash room.
To maybe, well, they didn't start with the trash room. They started with a cubicle. Then they're like, okay. You're too messy to be in a cubicle.
Yeah, remember when they were like, we need to know what you do every day, and then you just wrote on the form OTB.
What's OTB stand for again? OTB office, yeah, off track betting. Yeah, OTB. Yeah. I'm famously, this is by the way how Nastassia and I got into Appleheads. I got into another argument with a partner / employer who was asking me a bunch of garbage that made no sense.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
no, that's they said you guys can't.
Well, we'll save it for when we do Applehead dolls.
No. Just say it now. We can bring it up again.
All right. What's
said,
Applehead?
So Applehead, guys cannot work together.
Yeah, you guys can't work together in other things. This is when we were starting
Booker
and
Dex. Business together.
We're starting. Yeah. So like they're like you and Nastassia can't start your own business together. And this is when we were doing Booker and Dax. And by the way, at that time, Nastassia, they weren't going to give Nastassia even ownership in Booker and Dax. So like, let's wait and see. This is like, you know what I mean? Let's wait and see.
Yeah.
So I was like, God damn it. I was like, if Nastassia and I want to go make Appleheads dolls together, we want to start an Applehead business, you're not going to stop me.
That's
pretty much exactly how that happened. Yes. And it's pretty much exactly what I said.
Yeah.
Was this Chinatown Times?
This is before Chinatown Times. Oh. This is when we used, we also, Booker and Dax's first headquarters was in the back of Milk Bar Commissary.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that, people?
Yeah.
Man, Tozy hated us because we were such a mess.
Every time you walk in there, all the Milk Bar people would kill you.
Yeah, they tried. They tried very much. Turns out, I mean, probably at my age now, I'm probably easy to kill. But back then, I was much more difficult to kill. Cockroach.
Yeah, but who's laughing now? Who's the multi-million-dollar business? Booker and Dax, right?
This episode was brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn, with meeting and event spaces available for on-demand booking. Looking for the next perfect outdoor location for your next gathering? Host your next event at 100 Bogart's impressive rooftop, just steps away from the Morgan L Stop. It's one of the largest and tallest roof spaces in Bushwick, boasting 360-degree views of Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Queens. 100 Bogart's rooftop is available for your next networking event, fundraiser, special performance, or photo shoot. There's approximately 5,000 square feet, ample space for up to 100 guests. For more information on hosting an event at 100 Bogart's rooftop, email info@100bogart.com or call 718-362-3539.
And then I had to throw it all away when I got rid of my house. I was like, saw all this stuff that I had like carried around for years, like little pieces of like weird equipment that I've carried around for years.
Remember.
Finally got rid of. You know what I did find the other day? And by the way, before Jeremiah and Fabulous opened Contra Wild Air, they came to we used to have a lab on 54 Eldridge, which was, by the way, is the ground spitting capital of the world.
Explain
as far as
what
I know.
Ground spitting is.
So like we tried to do a video when we were going to sell the Searsol, and we were trying to do a video in our lab. And the person who was miking us could not get a clean sound take without a loogie being hocked in the background. In fact, for years before Peter Kim from the Museum of Food and Drink is now my generalized ringtone. Him yelling in pain as he knuckles into the puffing gun the first time he ever tried to hit it is my ringtone. But before that, it used to be from the Searsol shoot, like a giant like right outside of our thing. And so we would just stand out there and like you couldn't do a 20-second take without a loogie hock. Yeah. And then when you walk, I saw Coconut Feet the other day.
I was with you.
Yeah, you remember Coconut Feet?
Yeah, of course.
So there was a guy.
He worked at the restaurant next door.
He would sit outside on a lawn chair peeling his feet.
In front of his restaurant.
Peeling his feet onto the ground. It used to make a little pile of shredded coconut on the ground. And so we always called him Coconut Feet.
It was like a vegetable peeler.
It was like a Swiss, like a Coon Recon Swiss peeler. Like an orange one.
And then people were like, I remember, forget somebody that don't remember nameless was like, you guys have it so easy. You guys, you know, all the resources you guys have. Meanwhile, like loogie and coconut feet. The reason literally we don't have a lab anymore is because we didn't have the money to fix the roll-up gate. And the roll-up gate was so broken that Nastasia one day, she yelled at me. So her word for the general like female stuff is modka.
Everything down there is modka.
You're going to break
like
my modka.
It's baby making area.
And
it's
capacity
expression,
and everything.
Expression, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, one day I'm like, I don't need to be there for you to open the office. You can just open the office, your freaking self. God! Because I was doing something else and I wanted, and Nastasia would not come into work unless she knew I was already going to be there. She would not come to work unless she knew I was already going to be there.
Open the gate.
That place was scary.
So then,
downstairs.
Literally, she had someone open it. And then she stood there hanging on it like a gymnast or like a monkey, like waiting for me to show up. And like, there's what you want. You want me to break my matka? and then we had some guy, quote unquote, fix it. All they did was pump 8 quarts of lift grease into it so that every time we touched the door from then on out, like we were coated in grease. Yeah. Stinky, stinky lift grease. And Estas and I were like, to hell with it, we're out of here. And literally, that's how we lost the lab.
Mm-hmm.
Such a beautiful space.
Anyway, so Fabulous, before he opened Contra, worked there for us.
The downstairs with the Jesus poster. And
oh my God, downstairs. So old school New York, we were talking to the landlord, and we're like, can we rent something downstairs? He's like, what do you want it for? And I was like, we need to store some stuff. He's like, oh, okay. I thought you were going to open another illegal gambling joint in the basement, because this entire block was illegal gambling joints and Coconut Feet people. So we went downstairs, and in the basement for our storage room was just a room. A room.
Mattress.
With 9 locks.
A mattress. The print of a refrigerator. You know how refrigerators who've been there for a million years and there's no cleaning, they have the line where the coils are on the back of the wall?
Yeah.
A picture of Jesus. A mirror on the ceiling. And then a bathroom with just a hose. And that's it.
And the locks were on the outside only.
The locks were only on the outside.
Yeah. You had to walk past that room to get to the other room where you kept all your stuff.
Yeah. It was amazing. It was an amazing place. I miss it. So then, anyway, but what I came across, and you were there for this, Fabulous, the very, very, very first Searsol that we ever made, the round one. I had it still.
You remember the first one was at FCA when you were Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Shoot it through a chinois.
And you had,
No, you made the shower. You made the shower head version at FCI
right before I left. But remember how people
got red torch?
Well, I have the. I should say I have the very first contained prototype that wasn't like showerhead. Remember we used to burn the hell out of ourselves with those first prototypes that weren't contained?
Yeah.
That's how we figured it out. We're like trying to shoot it through this mesh and then our knuckles would catch on fire. And we're like, maybe we should enclose it. You know what I mean? Oh, by the way, Dax says to me a couple weeks ago, he's like, Dad, how come you don't know how to use Instagram or the internet? I'm like, because I don't care. You know, he's like, someone on Instagram said that Dave Chang invented the Sears All and you didn't.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, I love this Dave, but that's just not the case. What?
This is what I was telling you last night. You don't check.
Nastasia Lopez says I'm not allowed to like a post that she puts up.
No. He'll like a
story. She's like, it seems robotic.
No, he'll like a story. And I said, we're close enough where I don't care that you like a story. It seems robotic.
But if I like your story, doesn't that help other people see your story?
No.
No, man. That's not how
it works. God, it does work like that.
No, yeah.
No, that's not true, Jeremiah. If he
I trust Jeremiah's skills over your skills, Nastasia.
But what does he do? Like, say, I like it?
He'll DM me. I like DM this.
That doesn't help anything.
No, I hit the like button, so it's.
But there's no like button
it.
For the story.
Exactly. You press on it and it puts
my
a heart on it.
DM, Dave.
You like press on it and puts a heart on it.
No, but you're sending her the heart.
Yeah.
I don't care about this stuff. So you guys is opening a wine store. How are you getting around the laws here?
What laws?
We're currently navigating all of them. Well.
You have to have a separate owner for the wine store, technically, right? A separate LLC.
Yeah, well, so we have a wine shop and a wine bar opening next to each other, but we're allowed to, as liquor license owners, we have one retail. Off-premise license, which is the shop, and then you can only, if you have an on-premise, which is what you have in a restaurant, you can only have one off-premise.
I didn't know you could have any.
So you could have 100 restaurants and one shop.
I didn't know you were allowed any.
If you're importing, you can't. But if you're only, if you have a sort of, let's say a restaurant, you can.
Really?
Yeah. You can have one, yeah. And then...
The problem is when you're bringing alcohol in, you can't have an importer and also a retail shop.
Right, well, you also can't technically have a grocery store and a wine store.
Yeah, because they split beer and grocery as one category. This is a super old law to basically make it fair for the people who are in... You know, so beer and grocery is allowed to be sold together, and wine has to be sold separately. So you can't.
This is New York people, by the way.
Yeah, we can't sell a piece of cheese in the wine shop.
Yeah.
No it's beer, crazy. No cider.
No, but also, like, remember, you can't. This is why Trader Joe's wine store is like a block away from Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
And why Whole Foods started a wine store on 59th Street and they couldn't because it has to be separate buildings. Like separate structures and all sorts of.
You can't just have like a different entrance. It needs to be like a different. You need like demising walls.
And this law clearly, you know, is important because no one in California like can get good wine at all. Where you can buy wine like anywhere.
Yeah, well, in California, you can have a restaurant and sell wine there in the same space.
So why are we here?
Just crazy.
Because we're not going to sink into the ocean, right?
Nah, man, have you like? It's like that's never going. To People have been saying that since I'm a kid. That it's going to sink off, fly off into the ocean. That was the whole thing.
I don't think anyone
said
it's
going to
fly
movie.
First.
Well, what'd you bring, Jeremiah?
Oh, so talk about the wine store. When's this going to open?
We're going to open in September.
Now, you guys were early on the... Is that like a real open in September? Or that's a...
Yeah.
We hope.
It's not. You're jinxing yourself is what I'm saying.
It's
going to open before next September.
Yeah. All right. So listen. Those of you that don't know, I don't know, maybe you've been under a rock or you haven't been paying attention. You guys have made, how long ago did you open Contra? Like 4 years, 3 years?
Six years ago.
What?
Yeah.
What?
6 years ago.
What?
Yes.
What? Oh my God, does time accelerate?
Yeah.
Oh my God, 6 years ago?
2013, yeah.
Jeez Louise, oh my God. So anyway, 6 years. What about Wilder?
Four years ago.
Jeez. Wilder's the four-year-old, yeah.
All right. So for those of you that don't know, over the past 6 years, Jeremiah and Fabulous have become kind of huge powerhouses in the food world. They're everywhere. They're all over the place. I knew them when, but I did.
No, we often talk about this, but you're the reason why the restaurants exist is because of you, because we met basically through you.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. That's so nice. And they have a cookbook out. How's that doing?
It's doing great. We're in our second pressing. It's called A Very Serious Cookbook. It's on sale now?
Yeah. On the Amazon? So anyway, so...
A drone will bring it to you?
So 6 years ago, Jeremiah and Fabulous, when they first opened, they were the earliest people that were playing at the level that they were playing at in New York City that I'm aware of that was a food place. Food place. Food! That
food.
Food library. You see Metalocalypse? Anyway, food library. They're the first place I know of at that level of food that was very dedicated to natural wines. Is that true? I mean, that's my impression, but is that true?
In New York.
Yes. I would, yeah. I mean, I would give credit to two of our good friends, Arno Earhart and Jorge Riera, who were running 360 in Red Hook. In 2004, which was like a really simple menu. They did like a $25 set menu, just like simple kind of fresh food, great ingredients, and just that was really one of the and also EC from Laurent Sayard, like much more bistro driven. But I would say in Manhattan we were like there was not a tasting menu, not a restaurant that was, you know, trying to do something that was elevated that had an entire list that was natural. What we classify as natural wine, even though, I mean, yeah. It's a stupid name.
And at the time, I made fun of you, like, relentlessly.
Yeah, everyone did.
I mean, you don't now?
Well, I still do. But, I mean, and so I think we've gone, like, kind of full circle with the, like, all, like, I was talking to Jack Schramm, you know, our head bartender, who is also a huge proponent of the natural wines. And, in fact, his ex-girlfriend used to work for you for a long time.
But, yeah, Mackenzie, yeah. She's...
But the thing is that I think even like the higher that like the old school sommeliers have kind of come around somewhat to your point of view, right?
Well, I just think that we've gotten to the point where if you just need to have like some of these wines on your list for younger people to relate to them.
Yeah, but what is it? I don't get it. I honestly I don't understand how it's happened. Here's what I think, and you tell me why I'm wrong, because I'm sure I am. It's like you have a like the old school like to play the old school sommelier game, right? It's only about like super expensive. It's about can I get this rare super expensive thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by old school? So that's like
Jean-Georges 20 years ago. So what I'm saying is
there's a generation between now and that.
Right, but like a lot of that generation still like so people like in their late 40s from my age, right? Like late 40s, like these people still grew up.
Well, it's a luxury thing. If it's pricey, then it must be good.
Well, but there's also like there's certain things that are recognized as the top of their game. Yeah. Like you know, have like how much of the you know the old growths have you had? Like this year, that year, et cetera, et cetera. Some connoisseurship of like some lesser known things, but by and large, the people out spending money. If they were going to drop money, they dropped money on something that was known, had a certain kind of pedigree, and it was kind of about that. You know what I mean?
Well, people don't want to spend money on something that they can't, you know, that they can't fully predict, or you know, if there's not very little consistency, or if there's no understanding of exactly what you know they're going to experience, because everything is so dialed in, you know, because when you're talking about conventional wines, so much of the wine. Is about what like what you're learning is through, you know, I know what like this year should take. That's why those guys can you know, the advanced somms, and when you do your masters, they can blind stuff. They can, you know, that's why they study that, because it's something that you can study. It's something tangible that you can study and learn certain right. years, certain regions, certain grapes have a certain profile. But they don't, you know, they don't always really appreciate the wines that are simply made, because this is really how people used to make wine, but it's kind of like when you're making wine.
Well, you used to make wine when? Hundreds of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, it's like, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure. You ever had wine on my honeymoon?
Did you Greece or something?
I was in Italy.
Okay.
I pulled over to the side of the road, and this lady was like, you know, try my wine.
Yeah, not everyone does it well.
And it was... garbage. And by the way, I was like very young guy, like we were like drinking Prosecco like it was soda pop. All right, I mean, like, I'm not saying I was like I need to be fancy, but even I
but there's no one saying that everyone that makes wine just because they're doing it, you know, at home and it's done right.
I make my cars the way we made them hundreds of years ago. not at all.
You do. You build everything yourself.
I do. That, not even if I'm bad at it. Yeah.
But I no. But I mean, it's less about. It's not like we've come up with all these ways to improve things. It's just we've come up with ways to. This is. I mean, making wine is one of the oldest. You know, beverage.
Even conventional is old.
Yeah, I mean, but like making wine conventionally, like it's brought it to a place where there's, you know, it's dialed it in, which I don't necessarily. Think is
guy in front of me eating pizza with a knife and fork. What country are these people from? Are they speaking English? Can you lip read?
Probably. Yeah, they're speaking English.
What the hell?
No.
What's worse, eating a pizza with a knife and fork or eating crust end first?
What language are they speaking?
What's worse, crust end first or knife and fork?
Knife and fork, I'd say.
Knife and fork worse than crust end first?
Yeah, why would you?
No, crust end first is the worst thing ever.
Really?
Yeah.
So one of Dax's dirtbag buddies.
You have no handle.
We had a birthday party, and we took a picture and sent the picture to Miley, my sister-in-law, who runs the Food Network magazine, and she says nothing but this, WTF, crust first, and then we, like, zoomed in on the picture, and, like, of all these kids there, she noticed that this one kid was eating crust first, and I was like, oh, yeah, he can't come back to my house.
Yeah, that's just, like, there's no sense to it. Why?
Yeah, why do you eat the handle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
You know what I mean? You've just eaten the handle.
It's like cooking with a pan and you grab the hot sauce.
You know what also, you know what I don't like? I don't like when there's no oil so that I can oil the crust at the end and eat it like it's bread. I like to oil the crust at the end.
Like a little olive oil.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so the middle generation you're talking about, I think, is like the Parker backlash, right? The people, so like the older generation.
Like maybe like Paul Greco and Joey Campanelli and like, you know.
Oh, even Joey's has a natural wine bar.
No, that's what I'm saying. No, but they're more, you know, like I think that they took an interest to... you know, more affordable wines, new world wines.
Yeah, but they're not affordable. That's the joke. They're not affordable.
A little bit more.
More than a first growth, but they're not affordable. Like, in other words, like, here's what I don't get, right? It's like, I can go out, and for $20, I can get a really good bottle of conventional wine, or I can get a lower-end crapshoot. Right? That, to me, like, that's the
What's
issue.
What's the lower-end crapshoot? What are
you
talking
about? Like, if you're going, like... What natural wines are like less than 20?
Most.
Come on.
Yeah.
At stores?
Yes.
No.
Yes, they're
no.
all 20.
What's
yeah.
this?
20. And it's like a. How much does this one cost?
This would be. At a store, this would be 33, 32.
That's what I'm saying.
No, but I'm just saying. I tell you. If you it's told like, me to, I'd bring a bunch of $20 wines. If, but,
all right, let's taste this.
Try
what do we
right
got?
So this is what I'll say. Okay, there's a complete misconception that natural wine. The overall cost of natural wine tends to be more expensive. But I would say more expensive than the cheap, because you have such a range. But we're talking about dollars, like a couple bucks here. Everything is in that, you know, $20 to $35 range. There's not a lot of wine that you're going to spend $50, like a lot of natural wine that you're going to spend $50 on. And
well, I don't think it has anything to do with the price. I think, like, wine is one of those things where if you like wine, you're going to buy expensive wine regardless. I just think that these winemakers are... just in line with what the food world is becoming, you know? And I think a lot of it, it's, you know, when we work with you, the food, just like the tendency was to be like modern and like use technology and do all these things to make the product better. And then that turned and, you know, now it's all about farming, where your vegetables come from, where everything comes from, you know, it's
but everyone who was good at anything back in the day cared about that stuff too.
No. Yeah, but I think it was I think it was a little less.
They cared about products being good, but not necessarily like seeing outside of, you know, now there's
I mean, that's just not the, you know, that's not the case. Back then was when that's back when I mean
you
Dan
remember
Barber was doing all of his
Andre Soldner used to have to he makes his tuck to ten with white bread. You know,
Andre Soldner, though, is like eight generations before any of us. He opened freaking Lutes in 1962 or 63.
So what years are you talking about? I mean, I think...
Like, the technology stuff wasn't happening. Andre Soldner didn't have a vacuum machine.
Oh, yeah.
And when I asked Andre Soldner why he never had a vacuum machine, he said, I buy fresh every day. I do not need a vacuum. And
no,
I was
but,
like...
But I think it was...
And I was like, you know...
Very,
I mean?
Very few people had the economical capacity to run a restaurant that could be technological at some degree and also care about... the produce they were bringing in.
But no, but although the people who were technological were all spending ridiculous amounts of money on their food, all buying from like local, all stuff. mean, look at where, like, Wiley used to buy his fish from. Look at the food cost of someone like, crazy food cost of someone like Lee Brandt back in the day, who was running, like, over 50% food cost because right. he was shipping in this very specific thing from a very specific producer.
Yeah, no, I mean,
think that's a false argument.
No,
that's
what he's talking about.
Like,
I think the quality,
bringing in fish from Japan versus...
The quality was always there, but I think now it's more important to be close to it than... You know, flying fish from Japan. Like we do is we talk to fishermen who fish, you know, who have fish, who it's domestic and it's close and we can have an interaction with it. Where like we know, you know, it's not about asking.
You're pulling out your NOMA stuff. Fabulous. No. Also worked at NOMA for a while.
No, I'm not pulling my NOMA stuff, but you know, at the restaurant we ask the fishermen, hey, like what's the best we can
get? You forage for mercury in the Hudson?
Yeah. And instead of, you know, getting halibut every week for the last 5 years. You know, I think there is a difference, and I think with these winemakers, it's the same difference. You know, these people become available to you. You can talk to them. You have the information of what's happening, as opposed to, you know, just buying wine from France, not ever talking to the winemaker, not knowing who picked the grapes, not knowing how the grapes were picked, not knowing all of this stuff.
I mean, look, I don't deal with the wine buying, but I know even the big spirits, like the actual makers, come and talk to you when you own a place. I mean, it's not like for the average person, is not going to know anyone because they're just going to a store. And the average chef who's interested in wine, average bar owner or sommelier, can know all of the people that make all the stuff at every level. That's just the truth in the industry. It's just what I think
can
it is.
Can or cannot?
Can.
That's not true.
It is 100% true.
With liquor, you mean?
With liquor.
Oh, with liquor.
And of like some like a lot of the wine buyers, a lot of the wine importers who do wine and liquor, they make the wine people available too. You know what I mean? So like
yeah, but there's a big difference. I mean, it depends if you're talking about. Even if you're talking to somebody who is part of the family, it's very different how much they actually are involved with the winemaking or how much they really know. You end up dealing with people who end up becoming salespeople, even though they're some extension of the family. They're the ones who travel, talk about these big wine houses because that's what they do. But if you're talking about understanding the true process of growing the grapes to making the wine and the people that actually do that, that is... You rarely ever see that on that level of the really high-end expensive wines because they don't have... You know, an interest or time to go and talk to a small restaurant. You know, maybe like a really expensive, maybe like a place like Le Bernardin, they might host, or Danielle, they might host a really special event that brings, you know, maybe a winemaker out from Burgundy or whatever, but you don't really have that access as like a restaurant on the Lower East Side, you know?
We're the scrappy folks from the Lower East Side.
Or whatever. Or like in Kansas City or in LA or, you know, or anywhere. Toronto.
We're just two scrappy little dudes from the Lower East Side. But the, you know what I think it is? And you're going to disagree. I think it really is that it gives you like a unique point of difference. Like the old world was knowable. Unattainable because of price and exclusivity, but knowable. Well, and this new world is unknowable because it's so big.
We're at the other spectrum now where it's just, you know, there's some people who respect it and who... sell these wines because that's what they believe in. And there's also the part of like, it's just trendy. You know, everything now, people now are so visual. Like you said, you know, Instagram is such a relevant tool for marketing. It's like people, you know, someone from Bon Appetit or someone from an important magazine or a celebrity, they post a photo of, you know, the labels of these so-called natural wines are so much more enticing than your old school bottle of wine. So if someone puts it up and they're like, this wine is so cool, the label's cool, and everyone's just, okay, cool. You know, there's like a really famous winemaker from Austria, Guregau, and he has these labels with like faces of families. And like you see it everywhere. Everyone posts about it all the time. And that's like, you know. Everyone,
I hate that stuff. Don't you hate that stuff?
Everyone knows those wines. My mom knows those wines. My girlfriend knows those wines.
What do you think? You're good at Instagram. What do you think about this Instagram stuff ability of the...
I mean, there's things I hate about it. There's things that I
think it's good for business.
Are useful, yeah. I mean, you know, you just... Before, you had to deal with media to put your thoughts out there. And, like, it was a distillation of what you believed in that someone listened to what you believed in, and then they wrote whatever they wanted. And now you can just share your point of view, just how it is, to everyone that follows you or people who don't follow you.
Right, so, by the way, what are we drinking? I didn't like the first sip, but I like it now, and my stepfather would hate it.
So specific.
My stepfather would hate it. My stepfather, by the way, My stepfather, like, he's an old school drinker. He's got a case of 85 DRC in his cellar that he bought as a future. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's the kind of like drinker he is. He's into like, he has some of that. He yelled at my mom he ruined Christmas one year because my mom bought him a case of 85 DRC, which is Romane Conti, Latash, Richebourg, all that stuff. A case as futures. She spent like, I think a couple hundred bucks on it at the time in like 1986, I guess, when the futures were released for the 85 year. And my stepfather ruined Christmas, yelled at her the entire time for spending that much money on that wine. The single bottle of Romane Conti that is now worth $25,000 on auction. Right. You know what I mean? And he hasn't drink it. He doesn't know what he's going to do with it. It's undrinkable because he's like, I can't drink $25,000, but I can't sell it either because I've never had it. So anyway, but he's into good value for traditional style stuff. He buys me stuff I like, which is like Barolos, Nemeronis and stuff like that. But, you know, he tends towards like, you know, Chateauneuf and whatever. Anyway.
You like big wines. You like big,
juicy. I started drinking right when Robert Parker, who's now retired, became popular. So I like that. I also enjoy like the giant, ridiculous American wines like Turley and like all that stuff. But I also like austere wines. You know, I like a range of
from
things.
From Austeria?
Yeah, Austeria. It's my favorite. It's like, yeah.
So we're drinking Matassa from our good friend Tom Lube. He's in Perpignan, just like in the south of France, in the Land de Lac Roussillon. This is, I think it's Macabeau, Viognier, Muscadet Alexandria, and Muscadet Blanc.
Right. So it's cloudy, fine. It's a lot of oxygen has hit it because it's acidic and oxidized.
There's a little bit of VA in there, which I think is blowing off right now because that's, and you were kind of not feeling that in the first sip, but so
that's volatile acidity for all you folks out there, which is AKA acetic acid, AKA oxygen was touching the wine.
It's like a Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang rapper, aka VA, aka Volatile City.
And feeding it.
But I think that, I mean, I think this is, I thought it, like, this is 2018, and I think you would have, like, 17 was a little bit cleaner, and I was not expecting it to be this wild, because I told, Anastasia asked me if I was going to bring something funky to kind of, like, show, and I was like, no, I was going to bring something, like, more mainstream.
I mean, the thing about, like, okay, so fair notice, I don't drink a lot of, like, if I want vinegar, I'll drink vinegar. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of kombuchas, like, there's other acidity. I don't like Basque cider very much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not that it's bad, but, like, there's a reason they have to pour it from, like, a five-story building for you to be able to drink it.
Yeah.
And, but the good thing about that is that after the first couple of sips, it does blow off, but also you acclimatize your palate to it, and then you're fine with it. You know what I mean? So, like, if that's meant to be the thing, that's meant to be the thing, and I'm good with it. I'm enjoying drinking this wine.
Yeah, I don't think that this is a characteristic of all natural wine.
But there's also a misconception where people who tend not to drink natural, quote-unquote, natural wines think that everyone who drinks natural wines think that all natural wines are good. Which is not true.
Yeah.
You know, even you know, winemakers, you'll buy a bottle of wine and it'll be amazing, and then you'll buy another bottle of wine and it'll be absolutely undrinkable. And a lot of it has to do with it is so much more volatile than the conventional, because conventional wines have, even natural wines have things put into it, but not as much as the conventional
ones.
Well,
nothing. Just a little bit of a little bit of SO2, that's it. I mean, but so this wine has a small amount of SO2. I mean, this year, I don't know if he did. I know in the past he has with this cuvée, but sometimes, you know, you kind of decide what you're going to do, but it's on such a minuscule level.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's like, it's not like, oh, if you like natural wine, you're like, I like wines. That's not really...
Hey, hey, family show.
Oh, I like funky wines.
Yeah.
That's not the... That's what you meant. That's not the point. It's, you know, there's plenty of wines that I could taste you on that you wouldn't know. Whatever is conventional. I mean, like,
as the geezer in the room, this was hilarious. So two chefs, I happen to know you personally, so it's not
who's
like
the geezer?
What, me?
Oh.
So like, like, oh, for sure. Like, when Nastasia is the frat boy in the group.
Stop. Did you know this? Dave can only have one frat boy friend.
Yeah, I only have one frat boy friend. It's Nastasia. Yeah.
Dude.
Oh my god. Oh my god. She's like, anyway, like, definitely if she sits on your coat, she's gonna be tooting on it. She's a super frat boy. Anyway. She handed someone, a friend of ours, she handed
he was like,
him,
I'm leaving. And yeah, I was sitting on his coat.
Sitting on his coat. Why? Who knows? I don't know why she didn't pick it up to put it on the back of the chair, but she's like, I tooted on this multiple times. And then hands it to him. I'm like, this is why you're a frat boy. So, but as a chef, right, here's the thing I find interesting about it is like all the people I know who as cooks are all about consistency 100% of the time are, excuse me, Jesus. God's choking me. Are all about like wines that like show this difference as agricultural product from year to year, from thing to thing. So it's like they're very non-interventionist in their wines, other than kind of like this hand of the maker kind of a thing. And yet in the kitchen are all about control.
No, but I mean, I think Fabian can attest, I would rather have like, well, eating and cooking, consistency is important, but you know, there's certain things I find important to be consistent. Other things, I like the nuances of it being different. And I don't like, that's why we cook every, excuse me, I just burped on. I'm the frat boy now. We, you know, when we cook and when we enjoy eating something, I like that, you know, something might be, you know, when it feels like it's done by hand and it feels like, you know, it's not a machine with a timer and somebody that, you know, is doesn't maybe necessarily have those intuitive skills to prepare something without those things. So, I mean, yeah, you don't want to be like, oh, we strive to be inconsistent, but I'd rather like, you know, we're cooking each piece of fish, you know, just in and out of an oven. So it's you know, one person might have a slightly different, like, we're not cutting each one with like a mold, like a ring mold and making a torchon so it all cooks perfectly. I think
you're saying that like I might get a bad piece of fish.
No, you're gonna have a different piece of fish from somebody who ate the day before or who's eating at 6 and you're eating at 8. But I mean, hopefully it's all good. It's like,
Fabulous is giving you a look like he's going to chop your head off.
No, I mean, that's fine. You know, not at all. I think it's, you know, it's somewhat true. I spend like a lot of time in those restaurants that everything, even, I mean, you mentioned Noma, but Noma was the same, you know, like even to a bigger degree because we were picking herbs and like herbs are like, you know, no, unless you work in a lab, herbs are just going to look different all the time. But you have to pick the herbs that look the same.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, you know? And I think you just spend so much time in places that like that that you crave the chaos a little bit. You know, you try to control as much as you can, but there's also aspects of just the uncertainty that are quite appealing.
You guys still make the squid at Wild Air?
No, we do soft shell crab in the summer.
Do we use that same batter?
Yeah.
Talk about your super crocante fried batter for the
It's gluten free.
Squiddle.
It's gluten free.
Gluten free for the new generation.
Yeah, give it to me. It's good though.
Yeah, we
But it's crunchy, but not super hard. I hate everyone who mistakes hard for crunchy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's corn and
which is weird because I normally don't like cornmeal batters.
Well, it's not like it's corn and potato.
You are.
I'm just potato.
Dave. We have 5 minutes.
Hold on. Wait, first, like, I gotta tell you. So, are you willing to give out the recipe? I like potato starch because it swells like a mother. It is?
Yeah. By the book.
That's great. There's squid, and I guess now there's soft shell crab. Delicious. You don't like this recipe?
I do, yeah.
It's a good recipe.
Yeah. I'm just thinking in my mind if it works.
Oh, if the recipe in the book is the same as the recipe?
I'm just kidding. It does
work. You know that chefs always lie.
Fabs gets a lot of DMs about recipes.
Well, chefs, like someone who's an actual professional chef is different from like they have to take something that they make in a restaurant, which is entirely different from how you would cook.
Well, you know when you make something, a recipe that's very specific and it works. But then you give it to someone else and they just mess it up.
Right, because they're not with you.
And like, I'm like, I don't know what to say, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
this works. My mom has been making this Chinese, like, it's a rice flour, it's like a mochi date cake. She's been literally making it for over 40 years. And she has to look at the recipe every time. It's on an index card. It's the same one she's had. It's like brown. And she photocopied that and gave it to a family friend, and it just was a mess. And like, that's the thing is, like, some things you write the recipe, but you don't really consider, oh, I kind of, well, I do this that way, and like, it's because of the temperature of my stove and this, you know, like, there's all these little things that you just can't explain.
Well, you know, it's like thinking about it. When you put a recipe in your book and it says iota carrageenan, and then someone messes you and they message you and they're like, hey, I don't even have iota, I had kappa, and it didn't work.
That's like, yeah.
And you're like, well.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have a kickball, I had a BB, and this game was not fun. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, yeah. Yeah, people are, yeah, as we all know, people are the worst. So, okay, so before I get into the final segment, which you guys are going to be part of, explain how Justino happened, the term Justino for blending liquor and
Justino. So my the sous chef at John George, when I was working for Johnny, was named Justin Beanie. And I don't know why we just kept talking about it. And who was it? Was it Weep Up?
You were calling Justino Clifford. Because we would all do fake Spanish. I mean, Fabulous is from Mexico City. Oh, his family's actually, you could talk about mummies too and Guanajuato.
Sure.
The mummies.
Like right now?
The strawberries, yeah. Anyways, but like he used to like do fake Spanish with me all the time. So we would call Justino. Justin Justino, which isn't fake. That's how you would say it.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
You want to talk about mummies?
Do you remember when he would go into convulsions? Like, no. When you like were on the floor. Yeah.
Justino! Like that? Remember when you used to do that all the time?
It's almost like you have a Justino stuck on your throat.
Yeah. Because Fabulous would work like a 12-hour day and then come back to school and be an intern. Like, did you ever sleep? Were you on methamphetamines?
No, he never sleeps.
Anyway, so like, this is how this, yeah. So then what happened?
I don't know. I actually, you know, to be honest, I don't think I was part of the process of how it began. I just came back one day and you guys had made a drink. And you were like, this is a Justino. Okay, cool.
Yeah. All right, so during the time that you guys were there, what was the worst thing and the best thing we made?
Worst thing, ketchup chocolate, for sure.
Everyone hated the ketchup chocolate.
I hate it to this day.
I mean,
conceptually, you love it, right?
Yeah, conceptually, I love it, yeah. Actually, I was in Copenhagen, and they were making chocolate out of rye or something. And they were like, oh, yeah, we made this fake chocolate. I was like...
You're like, wah, wah. You're like, you're 5 years too late, Abel. Yeah. So what was good then?
The Cracker Jack.
Oh, the pork rinds Cracker Jacks?
No, the... We made the bourbon ones.
Wait, which ones?
We made... we distilled, like...
You're talking about the actual...
Yeah, that was good.
I actually like the...
Beaver Tail. Puff Beaver Tail is good.
Yeah, Puff Beaver Tail is good.
I mean, the onion ice cream wasn't bad.
Onion ice cream was good.
Actually, no. The best thing I got. The best thing orange? Was when we went to buy those ducks.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
oh,
that breast duck.
So I mean, the interns wanted to make pressed duck. This was when, like 2010 or something.
No, yeah, well, no. This is eight.
Yeah, so we went to go buy. I was like, if you want to do pressed duck for real, because I think Danielle had donated a duck press to the French Culinary Institute for, like, you know, Sultner or Sayak or one of these old school French chefs. So it's in the library, and I'm like, the hell? It's just sitting in the library? This is garbage. You know what I mean? And so one of our interns, I think it was Yahtzee, right? Was it Yahtzee?
Yeah, it was Yahtzee.
Who wanted to make pressed duck. I was like, well, you know, if you really want to make pressed duck, you can't just go buy duck. It has to be duck with the blood in it, so you can't, like, cut it or do anything normal. So we had to go buy a duck from a live poultry place. And I was like, and I can't be part of this in any way, shape, or form.
This was a perfect example of why I don't speak Spanish to people, just because he made me speak Spanish to the people who work there.
It's in a Spanish neighborhood.
And they're like, we don't speak Spanish.
But then you kept doing it. And he's like, I told you, this is a halal joint. I don't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah.
But yeah. Then we bought the ducks, took them back to...
I was not a part of this, people. What's about to transpire, I was not a part of.
We took them back to Nick Wong's apartment.
Who's from...
And then, yeah.
Nick Wong, now the chef at UB Preserve.
Yeah.
And they had to dispatch them personally in a humane way, but in a way that was good for the thing. And I could not be a part of it. So it was a nightmare, right, for you?
Yeah, it was.
It was a nightmare. The duck was good.
Yeah, duck was good. Yeah.
Duck was good. Okay, now, we have a new segment on the show. By the way, what's the name of the wine shop going to be?
Peoples.
Peoples?
Yeah,
Peoples.
Peoples?
Peoples.
Not peepholes.
No.
Peebles?
Peoples.
With a B?
No, like peoples. With a P.
Peebo. Like Peebo.
Like pee-pee peoples.
Like everyday peoples?
Yes.
Yeah.
Peoples.
Exactly. Peoples.
Isn't Peoples like a store?
It used to be. It used to be a drugstore. You remember that?
Yeah, Peoples.
Yeah, it became CVS.
Let me ask you a question. Doesn't this have bad search engine optimization?
Peoples?
Peoples.
There can't be anything that comes up when you look up Peoples.
Yeah. Peoples!
Peoples.
Peoples. And then you could do McGilla Gorilla, but he was Peebles. Mr. Peebles. Remember this? Anyway, for those of you that like... so Mr. now... okay, good. So we got that out of the way. What's the name of the wine bar going to be called? Also Peebles?
Peebles? Peebles.
Now, is that a legal problem calling the store and the wine bar Peebles?
Well, it's going to be called Peebles Wine Bar.
And the other one's
or the wine bar at Peebles. We still
don't know. The wine bar at Peebles?
The wine shop at Peebles. The Peebles Wine Shop.
Peebles Wine Shop.
Can you have a mascot, Mr. Peebles, and like have it...
Yeah.
What do you think their story is?
Who?
This is interesting.
Construction workers?
I don't know. Oh, this is the concrete warehouse supply center of the city, which is why all the streets around here are terrible and you get choked out with concrete dust when you walk out the door. And there's big plops of concrete in the bike lanes that cause me to almost die every time I ride my bike around here. So if you need concrete in the greater New York metro area, come to Bushwick, where it's like hipsters and concrete. We got everything you need. We got hipsters. We got concrete. Anyway, so...
go, Dave.
Hi, Anastasia. Louise. Jeez,
God,
Louise.
It's like 15 after.
So now we come to the... It's going to be the final segment. We got no callers, by the way. People don't like us anymore.
Can you stop with that?
Why do you usually get callers?
Sometimes.
Oh. We had no questions, no callers. We called
people don't have phones anymore.
Should we just stop?
All right, so this is called Classics in the Field. Yeah. It's about classics in the field.
Did you find
them? Yeah. So today's classic is actually, you ever been to, where's Powell's Books? Powell's Books is in Portland, right? So I was in Portland,
yeah.
And you go to Powell's
Portland,
Books.
Portland, Oregon?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've been there.
Yeah, yeah. Not Portland, Maine.
We've been there too.
Oh. So I was there and I found this random book called The Bull Cook and Authentic Historical Recipes and Practices. And I searched through it and it is the craziest cookbook that I think has ever. So the story is there's a guy named George Herder in Waseca, Minnesota, who in 1935 started an outdoor store, like Cabela's or something like this. But he was also, like Sears Roebuck, he had a catalog, and this catalog shipped everywhere. And so he became one of the best-known kind of outdoor dealers. The business went bankrupt in 1977. Cabela's, and it went bankrupt, it's kind of an interesting... Like, I won't get into it, we don't have time, but like, basically, like, someone who clearly has a certain political bent was like, as soon as they stopped being able to sell guns over the over the mails in the thing, he went out of business. So it was like, but anyway, so it was like hardcore, like, they sold guns and ammo and so, anyway, Cabela's bought the name, and you can still buy Herder's brand, I think, like decoys and ammos from Cabela's if you want to. So, but George Herder, aside from being an outdoors person,
was a natural wine enthusiast.
It was natural wine enthusiast. That's exactly what it was. But basically, he started writing a series of books. He started writing in 1959, published them in 60, called The Bull Cook and Authentic Historical Recipes and Practices, Volume 1, 2, 3. He also has a lot of other well-known books, and you can look through it. Like the list of books he's published are. I'll give you some. Professional Fly Tying and Tackle Making Manual and Manufacturer's Guide, Fitting and Finishing Gun Stocks, The Professional Net Making Manual. And here's the good one. The Only Way to Professionally Fillet and Clean Fish.
Oh, wow.
Strong. So these books, the interesting thing about it is that he is an old school crank, like a hard old school crank. So... You know, he's a mid-20th century, like, white guy, American, conservative. He hated New York City. He hated all that. He says things that are, whatever. You know, so it comes with everything that it would come with. But you have to read these books because...
Orientals.
Oh, my God. That's, yeah,
that's
for sure. Like.
That's mild.
Yeah, yeah. But he's not, it's not like, he's not, like, saying anything... he's not intending to be at all. He's not like an overt racist in the book or an overt misogynist in the book, but he says things that are, yeah, like Oriental, which is just, you know, at the time, or like the ways that Native Americans are characterized, which he thinks he's characterizing them in a good way, but obviously, you know. But that's not what's interesting about the books. What's interesting about the books is they are 100% factually incorrect. So he was writing in a time when he was one of these weird semi-learned people who traveled the world taking notes on things and then writing, above all, recipe books with all of these weird stories that are just dead wrong. And if you look it up, for some reason, it's not it's on the internet. I don't know why, because it's not in the public domain yet. But you have to read some of this. The very beginning of it says, in the lumber camp days, in pioneer days, the cooks learned from each other the secrets of old world cooks. Each taught each other, each taught the other country's secrets. Out of this mixing came fine food prepared as nowhere else in the world. I'm putting down some of these recipes that you will not find in cookbooks. Each recipe here is a real cooking secret. So throughout all of this, he says he's giving you all these like crazy secrets that you can't know anywhere else. I'm also publishing for the first time authentic historical recipes of great importance. By the way, none of them are authentic historical recipes. For your convenience, I will start with meats, fish, eggs, soups, and sauces and sandwiches, the art of French frying, desserts, how to dress game, how to properly sharpen a knife, how to make wines and beer, which his recipes are terrible, how to make French soap, and here's my favorite, what to do in case of hydrogen or cobalt bomb attack, keeping as much in alphabetical order as possible. So for those of you that don't know, a cobalt bomb is when they add stuff like cobalt to an atomic weapon to make it rain more radioactive fallout on you. And I'll give you in a nutshell what he says to do in case of a hydrogen bomb attack. He says that what you want to do is don't go in your basement. He's like, everyone says to go in your basement. He hates magazines, by the way, even though he was a huge catalog salesperson. He hates magazines and editors of cooking sections especially. Like, every other page is a reference to how much he hates these people. And he says, anyone that tells you to go in your basement is an idiot. You're going to be crushed by all of the house that falls on you in your basement. He says you want 2 5-pound containers of tobacco. He says that's going to be your money. He's like, when money is worthless, tobacco will still be currency. And he says get a .22 rifle and 1,000 rounds of ammunition so that you can hunt squirrel and whatnot when the time comes. This is his recipes for success in a cobalt bomb attack. Anyway, let me give you some other stuff. So, like I say, everything he says is wrong. So, like, literally everything he says is wrong. I try to find one. I wish I had time to get into this. He has a whole section on Wyatt Earp. You know Wyatt Earp?
Yes.
From the OK Corral? Yeah. He goes, at Dodge, his boiled sliced buffalo tongue pickled in vinegar and his thinly sliced buffalo liver fried with bacon and onions were famous. His Wyatt Earp breakfast, consisting of half-inch thick slice of beef or buffalo eye of rib steak with thinly sliced onions on top, put between 2 slices of buttered bread with the butter well sprinkled with salt and served with 2 fried eggs, was both very popular and justly so. And then he gives a recipe for, here's the Oriental Saloon that Wyatt Earp ran. He gives a recipe for Wyatt Earp's doves. And so he gives this whole long recipe. First of all, he goes into how Wyatt Earp used to shoot people, et cetera, et cetera. And then he goes into this entire thing about how Wyatt Earp cooked doves and the whole secret of Wyatt Earp's doves. Ready for it? Soy sauce. Soy sauce. Soy sauce. He has fake secrets for fried chicken. He says never use charcoal for broiling, by the way. He hates charcoal. Says it's noxious and gives off noxious stuff. He was also a believer, early believer, in alkaline versus acidic foods and acidosis, which is one of my favorite crank health theories of all time. But he says,
you don't think that sometimes you need a balance of alkaline and acidic foods? Or
It's all hokum, dude. Like, what, are you going to stick a pH paper in your butt and figure out what your pH is?
No. I'm just saying, like, eating more, like, high alkaline foods when you know you've had a very highly acidic diet.
Yeah, but acidic and alkaline don't mean any, like, in other words, like, maybe if they said if you eat a lot of this, eat this other thing. But, like, for instance, apples are an alkaline food.
Yeah.
Why?
Lemons are an alkaline food.
Yeah, why? What does that mean?
Ah.
Give me a meaning for it.
It's supposed to, in the pH-wise, I guess.
Of what? Your butt? Balance. pH of what? Your blood? Like what? Like
this?
Like,
butt like doesn't no one, have like, a pH.
Again, like this doesn't like make any sense to me at all. But he says, Always use hard coal. It gives off no carbon fumes like charcoal. No such thing. And it gives the meat, fish, or fowl a much cleaner taste. Hard coal never obscures the flavor of meat, fish, fowl, as charcoal definitely does. The use of hard coal, like anthracite coal is what he cooks with, instead of charcoal in Minnesota for broiling has always been the accepted practice. Many other parts of America also discover this to be true. The famous restaurant Gage and Tollner's in Brooklyn, which unquestionably broils the finest fish and meat in the East, uses nothing but hard coal, never charcoal. Then he gives a recipe for, the guy liked fake, the guy, here's some fake history for you. Mary Louisa Roquefort stuffed chopped beef. Mary Louisa was an Austrian woman, the daughter of Francis I of Austria. She married Napoleon I of France, becoming the Empress of France. The French spelling of her name is Marie-Louise, the same as it is spelled in English. Austrian cooking has always been excellent. This is true. This is not a lie. He says, Mary Louise was a woman who instinctively knew good food combinations. Her Roquefort stuffed chopped beef, if you like cheese, is one of the fine dishes, and like all really good recipes, is simple to make if you know the trick. And then he gives, quote unquote, the original recipe, which is ground beef and Roquefort cheese, like on a bun. It's like, as though, and then he says that Napoleon would order this constantly. He said, Roquefort stuffed chopped beef and chow chow mustard pickles. Chow chow mustard pickles are an American thing, straight up. He goes, Roquefort stuffed chopped beef and chow chow mustard pickles and French fried potatoes were one of Napoleon's favorite meals. I don't know where he gets this stuff. When he was prisoner on St. Helena Island, he requested that he would be served this menu item at least once a week. His request was never granted. I have always thought that this was carrying punishment way too far. And then he also goes on a diatribe about how everyone else messes up this recipe that you've never heard of by cooking it wrong. It's like the whole book is an amazing just diatribe against everybody. Palm Springs, cookbook writers. Like, he hates Palm Springs, loves the place. He literally, I believe, wanted Palm Springs to be cobalt bombed so that he could get rid of all the humans and people could go back in there and live nicely. And the one piece of advice I've never tried of his, which I think I, like someday if you ever need to, and I think I said this on the air before, if you need to kill a turtle and it's pulled into its shell, what do?
You put a chopstick in its butt.
Ding, ding, ding. Did I tell you this one?
That was his advice?
Yeah.
I learned that from you.
Yeah. Well, that's because I learned it from him. Oh. So, and then you stick a stick out, you put the chopstick in its butt, it bites the stick, yeah. Chop off the head.
Yeah.
All right.
I just thought Chinese people came up with that.
Well, yeah. No, I don't know. Maybe. Who knows?
Maybe this guy did.
George Herter, the bull cook and authentic recipes. Classics in the field. Go look it up. Go find it on the internet. It's not as cool now in the era of like fake news where like, you know, everything we see is fake all the time. But like back then, like it was a good dose of, can you believe this guy actually wrote this book? And some of the recipes I've actually tried. Some of the recipes are actually decent. Almost all of the history is fake with a little sprinkling of truth. So don't necessarily take his advice on how to survive a hydrogen bomb attack. You guys got any last words on the show? They're looking at each other nodding. People can't hear the nods.
Check out the L. Fab and Jerry show.
Oh, no. Can't plug another.
Oh, wait. Yeah, you can. I thought you guys were going to have us on.
Yeah, because we're going to have you guys on, hopefully.
When are you going to have us on?
Let's do it this weekend, Saturday, at like 3 or something like that.
Stassi doesn't, like, where is it? Is it shot in Brooklyn?
It's in the Canal Street Market.
Canal Street Market.
Okay. It's on Canal and like Lafayette, right by the school.
Oh, that's such a nostalgia.
Does that work for you guys?
We'll talk about it at lunch.
All right. Anyway, thanks, guys. Thanks, Fabulous. Show. Thanks, Jeremiah.
Thank you.
Cooking Issues.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.